In an era of deportations, challenges to voting rights, and more, is the legacy of Lyndon Johnson's Great Society under assault? Good Wednesday morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9, and thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live on the radio at 9. Also, make sure to get our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and through our WJCT app. Just ahead, we speak with author Joshua Zeitz about his new book, Building the Great Society, a look at the Johnson presidency. You can get on the line now. Join the conversation at 549-2937. Then later, just because it's winter in Florida doesn't mean you have to stop planting your garden. Going Green looks at that, plus travel writer Judy Wells, and how you can quit smoking this year, courtesy of tobacco-free Florida. All of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, imagine what this country would be like without Medicare, Medicaid, public broadcasting, voting rights, federal funding for public schools, and environmental protections. All of those initiatives and more came out of President Lyndon Johnson's Great Society. Now, the Great Society was billed as a collection of programs the 36th president vowed would lead to an end to poverty and racial injustice. Not all of that came to fruition, of course, but under Johnson, schools were integrated, African Americans were finally granted the right to vote, poor people and senior citizens were guaranteed access to medical care, and other programs were boosted to give poor citizens greater food security. As President Trump gave his first State of the Union address last night, it's worth noting that the first president to give that address on television in the evening was actually Lyndon Johnson. Back in 1965, yeah, Johnson broke with tradition and gave the address at night for the first time instead of in the daytime. He was just trying to reach a wider audience. The Johnson presidency is the focus of a fascinating new book looking at the way his Great Society continues to influence America in countless ways today. That, even though many of its signature items, from civil and voting rights to environmental protections and aid to public schools, are today under assault. Joshua Zeitz is a contributing editor at Politico magazine, and he's the author of Building the Great Society, Inside Lyndon Johnson's White House, and he's on the line. Joshua, thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And the number to join the show as we talk about Lyndon Johnson's Great Society and Joshua Zeitz's new book, the number 549-2937, that's 549-2937, or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaNJax. You can also weigh in on Facebook. And you know, Joshua, as we talk about President Trump's State of the Union address last night, and of course, many are still talking about it, I think it's interesting to note as your book comes out this week that ever since the era of the Great Society, there's been a real divide in this country over whether you think those types of programs that Johnson pushed through worked or whether they were actually damaging. And in your book, what's so fascinating to note is that Johnson got these really transformative programs through, not only by dint of the fact that he was such a strong figure, but he had an amazing staff, too, that really knew how to work Washington and push this stuff through. Everything from Head Start to school integration, Medicare, Medicaid, voting rights. It was just such a sweeping transformational change to society. And I think it's really Johnson really has not gotten the credit that he deserved, I don't think, historically, in the way that he changed society on so many levels. So your book really does delve into that.
Well, thank you. No, I think that's exactly right. We haven't really had a president who's had such a transformational and sweeping impact on the country since LBJ, and before him, probably, you know, the closest would have been FDR, who was his idol. And when you look at that list of accomplishment and think about the fact that they managed to do this in the space of 5 years, not just pass these initiatives, but build them up. I mean, Medicare was, you know, from the day it was signed into law to the day it was implemented was simply 11 months, which was a remarkable achievement. They did all of this while at the same time desegregating schools and hospitals and nursing homes, places of public accommodations, voting booths throughout a third of the country. And they did it while becoming increasingly mired in the Vietnam War, which actually put an enormous strain both on the administration's credibility as well as the funding source for many of these social programs that get bundled up into the Great Society. And you know, the book looks at this talented White House staff that did not only help get the bill through Congress, but then help build these programs, make them sustainable. And they did it while working for this tremendously complicated president who was both a visionary but also a very difficult person to work for.
Certainly a complicated leader, a complicated legacy. Vietnam hung over his presidency above all other issues. But, you know, something else you note in your book is that the Great Society, Republicans hated it. They hated its legacy to this day. But you argue that it really was more of a centrist program in many ways than a hard left program.
Yeah, ever since the you know, Ronald Reagan gave a scorching speech around 1983 that denounced the Great Society as having been, you know, a series of left-wing radical initiatives that that ultimately expanded government and limited individual freedom. People like Paul Ryan have been outspoken in their belief that these programs have been redistributionist, that they've, you know, fostered generations of dependency on the government. The Great Society is actually quite centrist, and opposition to it is actually on the far fringes of American political tradition. The architects and framers of these programs, you rattled off a bunch of them: Medicare and Medicaid, aid to secondary and primary education, public schools, civil rights, job training, Head Start. You know, they considered when they were looking at how to tackle questions of poverty and inequality, they considered, you know, ways that you might redistribute the pie, so to speak, like a negative income tax or a minimum family income. But they built these programs in an era of widely shared prosperity and faith that you could continue to grow the economy at low inflation in perpetuity. It was an era when most people had access to good unionized jobs or middle-class jobs that had defined benefits pensions, that had employer-guaranteed health care. Wages were rising. Most families were, you know, a single earner, but double, you know, two-parent families. And so they rejected this call for redistribution and instead believed that if you embrace qualitative means to help people who were on the margins of society access all of that prosperity and opportunity through job training, through education, through supplementary help for nutritional assistance or health care, that they would be able to ultimately rise into the ranks of the middle class. And that's a pretty centrist vision, and in some ways I think the Great Society bears more criticism from the left for having not anticipated a world in which those good unionized jobs disappeared, and with it the employer health care and the employer provided health care and the pensions and the good wages, which have been replaced by you know, a lot of folks now living, you know, working minimum wage jobs in service industries without those benefits. So I think there's a legitimate question as to whether the Great Society programs are adequate in a 21st century economy, but that makes it more susceptible to criticism from the left. I think right-wing criticism of it is based on a caricature, which is just historically illiterate.
Your argument then is that the Great Society merits reconsideration, how to strengthen it, not to dismantle it. So
if it's
being re-looked at from both sides of the spectrum, how would you reframe our look at all of these programs? Because it's hard to imagine America without Medicare, without voting rights, without integrated public spaces, federally guaranteed college loans. These are all things we take for granted today. And most Americans, especially young Americans, might not realize they wouldn't enjoy all of this stuff without Lyndon B. Johnson.
That's right. Look, 130 million people, that's 40% of the country, rely on Medicare and Medicaid for health care. These programs are simply indispensable. 30 million children rely on subsidized school lunches and breakfast in order to have nutritional security, you know, food security. 20 million families rely on SNAP. These were all Great Society programs. Programs like Head Start remain broadly popular. And while I think it's very clear that there are more people on the extreme right than we might have imagined before last year who would like to roll back some of the protections afforded by the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, that's not a broadly held proposition. So I think the question is, what do you, if these have become inadequate programs, or if they were built for a mid-century economy and they're no longer adequate today, what are the alternatives? I think it's interesting that in her campaign memoir, Hillary Clinton revealed that she had come very close to adopting a guaranteed basic family income proposal, but couldn't make the math work. So to your point, I think the question is, how do you strengthen these programs while at the same time also trying to address the problems that have led to the strain on those programs? I mean, the fundamental problem is not Medicaid. The fundamental problem is that so many working people don't have access to employer health care. And if they don't, what is the alternative to that?
Guaranteed basic income. That's a conversation for another show, and one that I know will light up the phones both for and against. But let's go to a few calls now for Joshua Zeitz. He's the author of Building the Great Society Inside Lyndon Johnson's White House. It's out this week. Bob in Atlantic Beach. Bob, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I see Lyndon Johnson as responsible for a lot of deaths of young Americans who went to Vietnam. And I also see Lyndon Johnson responsible for starting the country's political divide to modern times. Johnson allowed and encouraged people who did not believe, let's say, in becoming drafted going to war, to ignore it and walk away from it. And I think that was wrong. I don't think Lyndon Johnson was a successful president. On the contrary, I think he actually hurt America. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for that, Bob. And of course, your book is about the Great Society, Joshua, but Johnson, under the cloud of Vietnam, walked away from the presidency, and that simply can't be ignored.
Yeah, this is what makes him such a fascinating character to study. I think the caller, you know, represents not only a widely held but also, you know, very credible position for a lot of people. Lyndon Johnson is the Vietnam War president, and it was the tragedy of his presidency that the Vietnam policy not only strained his ability to fund and expand the Great Society programs, but it also eroded his credibility and split up the political coalition that he relied on to support the Great Society. He lost the faces of many students, many families who did send their boys to Vietnam, who resented both the war policy itself as well as the militancy and the anti-war opposition. It really fractured the Democratic coalition. And I think in many ways was the precipitating event behind another decade or two of political upheaval. It certainly paved the way for Richard Nixon's victory in 1968. But this is the paradox and tragedy of Lyndon Johnson, that he left behind such a formidable domestic policy legacy, but ultimately Vietnam was what, as to your point, led him to walk away from the presidency in 1968.
Mark is in St. Augustine. Hey, Mark. Good morning.
Good morning. I was just kind of curious. I wanted to ask your guest. He makes a lot of cases about the merits of, you know, Great Society programs and all that, which back in the day, I guess I don't really dispute. But how does he reconcile today's issues with those when they were created as it relates to how many people were paying into the system versus how many people were pulling out? If you had, I'm going to kind of make up a number, but let's say you had 15 workers or employees paying into a system for every one recipient. Back when it was created, it seems to me that was a much more financially stable design. And now, maybe through unintended consequences, now you have three people paying into a system for every one recipient. And until that can kind of be corrected, I see that as a fundamental flaw in applying those programs today.
Right. Thanks, Mark. And you talk about that in the book, Joshua, that the architects of the Great Society foresaw a continually expanding economy. It's hard to predict the future. And so what about Mark's point?
No, I mean, it's a very credible one, particularly when you talk about Medicare. I mean, I would say that a lot of recipients of Great Society programming are also working people. They're not unemployed, and so they do pay payroll taxes and in some cases income taxes. So I think it's a little more complicated than saying people paying in and people taking out. But that having been said, I mean, his point is a valid one, which is that these programs, the anti-poverty programs anyway, let's put civil rights and aid to education to the side for a moment, but those anti-poverty programs were intended to help people caught the margins. They weren't, and it never was their anticipation that so many working people, people who have jobs and go to work every day, would be working at minimum wage without employer health care, employer-based health care, or defined benefits pensions. So these programs in some ways weren't built for the economy we have today. Now the question is, what do you do about that? Do you eliminate the programs, or do you use them as a stopgap while you try to address these larger structural problems in the economy? That's a little bit beyond the scope of my book. But
it's certainly a fascinating look at what was done some 50 years ago and poses some questions that are so vital for where we are right now. Joshua Zeitz, he's a contributing editor at Politico Magazine, and he's the author of Building the Great Society, Inside Lyndon Johnson's White House. Joshua, thanks for being on the show. That book is out this week. Thank you. Much more still ahead on this show later. Travel ideas for 2018 from our own Judy Wells. She'll stop by. Also, Tobacco-Free Florida wants you to quit smoking this year. How you can access their free, it's free, toolkit. But up next, going green on winter planting ideas for your Florida garden. Back in a moment.
Sunday nights for fresh programming beginning at 9 with On the Beam with me, David Luckin, as we spotlight music from the 30s and 40s.
I'm on the beam, time's flying by.
Followed by Taste Test with host Damian Lamar presenting Urban Radio After Dark.
There is a place that I'm saving.
On the Beam and Taste Test, Sunday nights at 9, only on 89.9 FM. Your community, your world, your music.
Calling all educators, WJCT and Community First Credit Union are proud to present the 5th Annual Teach Conference, an event created by teachers to engage, empower, and inspire. Saturday, February 10th at the Hyatt Regency Hotel. Tickets are $30. Tickets purchased for the 2016 and 2017 events will be honored. Share ideas with colleagues, learn new ways to engage students, and empower yourself to inspire others. Bring a friend and get your tickets today at wjct.org/teach. Take a drive with us into the Blues Horizon every Monday and Wednesday night at 11. The best in classic and modern blues as part of WJCT's After Hours. Every Monday and Wednesday night at 11 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world, your music.
I don't want no woman telling me what to do.
This Going Green segment is made possible by A1A Solar.
Welcome back. Well, it's the cool winter season in Florida. Actually, a great time of year in this part of the country for growing all kinds of wonderful crops. You can do a variety of winter planting right now, even if you have nothing but room for a tiny container garden. That's right. In today's Going Green, Zag Fury from Garden of Eden joins us now with some ideas on what you can plant right now in the winter season. Hey, Zach.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
And even if all you want to do is a little container garden, Zach says, you know what? You can grow some cool stuff, grow your own little garden right now in the winter, feed your family with it. And the number to ask Zach questions about what to plant right now is 549-2937. So I would think it's kind of a dead time for gardening, but you say no, get out there and garden.
Absolutely. I mean, especially here in Florida, with the warmer weather that we have, it's much more comfortable than toiling and sweating in the summer months.
Yeah, sure.
So many of my clients, you know, they've always had tomatoes and stuff like that. And then after I, you know, install a garden for them and I tell them about, you know, the different things that they can grow, such as lettuces, and you can always grow herbs all year round. They really end up liking the winter gardening more so than the summer gardening.
Yeah, it's nobody wants to be out weeding in August if they
exactly.
can avoid it.
Well, another thing too with raised beds, there's a lot of benefits with it. And especially this time of year, there's fewer insects. And with raised beds, there's less weeding, there's less watering. And again, when you're doing it in the winter, it's nice to be able to be outside and really enjoy it. It's mental therapy too.
You do container gardens for people. You go in, install it. It's raised on a platform, and it's just a little easier to maintain that way than bending over and weeding and pulling the crops out of the ground.
Yeah, it's much more easier to maintain that way. People use them a lot more because of it. And they, apart from it being easy to get whatever small weeds may show up, there's a lot of other benefits too. It drains a lot better than if you were to have something in the soil. And when you have vegetables that are sitting in something that's just too wet, they can begin to rot and become waterlogged and stuff like that. Also, when you're, you know, gardening in a raised bed in the wintertime, the soil in a raised bed actually stays warmer than the soil in the ground and stuff like that. So your crops have a much better chance of surviving and stuff like that. In addition to, of course, the obvious, you know, Florida soil doesn't have much organic matter in it. So whenever you do it in the ground, it's a much more laborious process of amending the soil and things like that.
So you're saying in Florida, if you want to do a traditional garden in the ground, you have to prep the soil a little more?
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you want to have any success, unless you just want to grow something like potatoes.
Which, hey, a lot of people around here grow potatoes.
Exactly. St. Augustine, there used to be a huge potato plot out there.
So what do you recommend people, should people be planting right now? Is now the time to plant?
In Florida, you can plant all year round. I mean, right now, as I said, we're planting things like, you know, herbs, obviously, and the different lettuces and broccoli and kale and chard. But also right now, as we're moving into, we're starting to move into the warmer months. I mean, knock on wood, at least I hope. We're starting to incorporate some of the more warmer weather crops too. It's like tomatoes and peppers. But I just always advise people, you know, you want to pay attention to them whenever we get really cold weather.
Can you really grow a tomato garden in a little container? They get pretty tall.
They do get pretty tall. I mean, tomatoes are the type of plant to where they'll end up getting so big to they almost kill themselves because you can't reach them. They'll get so tall.
I would think you'd have to put that in the ground, no?
You could put it in the ground. A lot of people do transplant it, but like I said, they don't do as well in the soil here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there anything that you should not plant right now? You should avoid?
The only thing that I would say that you should not plant or avoid right now, even though I do it with every client and I just tell them to watch out for it, is the herb that everybody loves but doesn't like the cold weather, which is basil. But
basil? Why not basil?
Basil is just very, very not cold tolerant. It likes the warmer weather, whereas like things like cilantro loves the cold weather and it doesn't like the heat.
Interesting. Okay, let's go to some calls now. It's going green today on the show. As we take regular looks here on this program at everything having to do with sustainability, the environment, and today we're talking about winter planting. It's the cool season in Florida. You can even plant herbs and vegetables with a tiny container garden, even if you live in a little apartment. Zach Fury is here from Garden of Eaton. Not Eden, Garden of Eaton, and he will take your calls. What are your questions? 549-2937. David is in Riverside. Hey, David. Good morning. What are your questions for Zach?
Good morning, Melissa and Zach. I'm going to be planting my summer garden seeds in flats, but I want to grow this year, again, beets and carrots in the garden, which I'll direct sow. And I'm wondering if it's this new moon, is it too early or is it a good new moon to do that in?
You said you're going to be doing your seeds in flats?
Yeah, that'll be indoors.
Like, yeah,
Eggplants, peppers.
Exactly.
I'm gonna start those indoors ahead of time and then transplant.
Yeah, when you're doing them indoors, now the timing isn't as critical whenever you're doing them indoors, and this is the perfect time for the crops that you're talking about. So, yeah, I would definitely go along with what you said you were going to do, is do them in seeds and flats indoors, and then once they start sprouting and becoming a little bit more mature, then you can start moving them out.
Yeah, but what do you think about the drip? I like the drip, so it's like carrots and beets.
What'd you say there? We missed part of that, David. Say that again.
Okay, sorry. I'm going to be direct sowing into the garden beets and carrots and some root crops.
Beets and carrots, okay.
Okay, you're going to be putting those seeds directly into the garden.
Yes, I will.
Mm-hmm. I would say that you probably missed it by a couple months on the beets and the carrots if you were going to be doing those directly in the garden.
So I should have done it earlier versus now.
Exactly, exactly. We're getting towards the end of the beets and the carrots. It'll probably be another 2 months. So if you were to start doing it right now, I mean, those are the types of things that take, you know, at least a good 3 months to mature. And by that time, it's going to be too warm, I'm afraid.
So he should wait until the fall of 2018 to plant those?
Exactly. I would say around September.
Very good. I appreciate you. Thank you.
Hey, no problem, Dave.
There you go. You really know your cycles. You really do. I mean, I think that's why so many people are hesitant to jump into this, because they're afraid of making a mistake.
Well, that's the thing. You can't be afraid of making a mistake. I mean, I've been doing this for 5 years now. I've always had a landscaping background, but this has just been so much fun just paying attention to it. And, you know, I've got probably 5 or 6 gardens at my house, and it's just... It's fun.
Five or six.
Yeah.
How much property do you have, Zach?
I've only got like 3/4 of an acre. They're not, you know.
Wow.
They're all varying sizes, but you know, it's fun to watch what happens and make note of. Okay, this did really well here, and this did really bad here, and you know, try and figure out exactly what's going on, and it's really rewarding too. You know.
What all do you have planted?
Oh, let's see. Right now, I'm doing some exotic stuff. We've got like some watermelon radishes going, some rainbow carrots, and...
Ooh, are they all different colors?
Mm-hmm. Yep. All different colors and stuff like that. They're beautiful whenever you cut into them, and they taste great and they look great on a plate. Apart from that, I'm also doing things like I did some, you know, good old-fashioned southern mustards and collards, and also the lettuces. Lettuces are probably my favorite thing this time of year.
And that's something anyone can grow. Those are easy, aren't they?
It's very, very low maintenance. I mean, it's not even, you know, tomatoes, yeah, you got to pay attention to them and you got to make sure that they're staked in the right way and stuff like that. With lettuces, it's just, you know, you just got to make sure that they're getting enough water and that's it.
And have you found that... You know, it used to be in this country that the majority of Americans grew their own food. We slowly, over the decades and centuries, got away from that.
Mm-hmm.
It's so funny to me now to watch how in the most urban of environments, people want to have chickens in their backyard.
Oh, yeah.
People want to have chickens so that they can grab eggs out of their backyard. They want to grow lettuce and carrots in their backyard. People have this really deep-seated urge to get back to this, even in a small way, back to this sort of agrarian way of living.
Yeah, it's kind of like a back down-to-earth movement, I think you could call it.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, like I said, not to sound redundant, but, I mean, it really is so rewarding. And, you know, you can really feel the benefits whenever you're growing your own food. Whenever you go from yard to table, it's retaining so much more nutrients that's lost, and you know, the convenience of going to the grocery store and grabbing a bag of lettuce. But I mean, whenever you get it out of your backyard, you're really getting much more than what you would get out of a grocery store.
Yeah. Any other tips you have for people that want to get started with this?
I would say just don't be over intimidated, and definitely, you know, if you're more interested, give us a shout at Garden of Eden Jacks on Facebook. That's probably the easiest way. And I'll make it as easy as possible for you and get you outside and loving life and eating good food.
All right. He's Zach Fury from Garden of Eden. Get out there and do some winter gardening. You might have to bundle up just a little bit, but not for much longer.
No,
right?
No. Only in the mornings, you know, and then you got to shed those layers.
That's right. Okay. We'll be right back, everybody.
We've updated the WJCT app to make it even better. Stay up to date with local and national NPR news from your phone or tablet. Listen live to First Coast Connect or any of your favorite radio programs. Stay connected and informed. Download the WJCT app today. Available at the Apple App Store and Google Play.
Wouldn't it be nice to know what's in the local daily newspaper, even if you have blindness or diminishing eyesight? WJCT's radio reading service can help. You'll hear what's in the Florida Times Union every day, articles, op-eds, obituaries, even the comics. Sign up at wjct.org/radio reading. Our thanks to Florida Eye Specialists, Delta Gamma of UNF, and the Radio Reading Service volunteer readers for giving voice to the printed word.
On the next Jazz Night in America, what does it mean to retire from jazz?
I would have liked it if I had examples and role models in the jazz world. The hard part was not deciding, but deciding when.
Gary Burton opens up, and we've got music from his final concert in the States. I'm Christian McBride, and that's on the next Jazz Night in America.
Saturday nights at 8 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, February marks both American Heart Month and National Cancer Prevention Month. Bringing further awareness to these causes, the Florida Department of Health's Tobacco Free Florida program is encouraging smokers to improve their heart health and reduce their cancer risk by making a plan to quit tobacco this month. Why? Well, smoking, as most people know, is a major cause of cardiovascular disease, and it causes one of every three deaths from CVD. Additionally, smoking can cause cancer almost anywhere in your body. But there's hope. Tobacco Free Florida has free tools and services for every resident in the state who's looking to work on their heart health and reduce their risk of cancer. Vicki Evans is Tobacco Program Manager with Tobacco Free Florida, and she's on the line. Hey, Vicki.
Good morning.
And you know, it's really important to point out that tobacco is still the leading cause of preventable death in this country. So Tobacco Free Florida is such an important program for people to access, and it's free. Anyone can give you guys a call and access this. How does Tobacco Free Florida help people quit smoking?
Well, we have a lot of resources available. We probably have the best state program of any place in the United States. And we have so many free and proven effective resources. There are 7 free resources that people have access to. One is the phone quit. Then, of course, we have the group quit, where we have support group classes. We have the web quit, which is an online program that people can access on their own time at home on their computer. We also have text to quit, email tips. We provide the 2-week starter kit of the nicotine replacement therapy, like the patch, lozenge, or gum. And then they will also mail people a quit guide, which will give them a lot of tips about how to deal with their smoking habit and how to plan for their quit attempt.
And one of the things I noticed that's on your website is something called Quit Your Way. You kind of put somebody together with a quit coach to help them understand their addiction and find the best choice for them to try to quit. Is that right?
Exactly.
Because people might not want to use a nicotine patch, maybe. They might want to do something different. Everybody has their own preference.
That's exactly right. Some people have issues with being able to come to the group quit classes, whether it be transportation issue, mobility issue, work schedule issue. So, of course, the other tools are there for them. You know, they can get a quit coach, like you mentioned, over the phone, and that person will coach them, help them come up with a quit plan, determine if the nicotine replacement products are right for them, and if they are, which one. And so there are a lot of different options, and that's why we call it Quit Your Way. So it really can be tailored to the individual's needs.
You also provide, for people that do decide to try the patch, you provide some free nicotine patches. How many? How long can people access that part of this?
Well, this is really amazing. We actually provide a 4-week supply of the patch, the lozenge, or the gum to everyone that comes to one of our group quit classes. If they can't come to a group quit class, they can call the phone quit line, and they will mail them a 2-week supply of the nicotine replacement product. So that's a big start, because it's been proven that if someone uses the nicotine replacement products with their quit attempt, that it will double the chance they'll be successful.
And if you're just tuning in, we're talking right now with Vicki Evans of Tobacco Free Florida. They're trying to get the word out about their free program to get more Floridians to quit smoking this month. It is American Heart Month in February and National Cancer Prevention Month. Now, you also, I notice on your website, want to raise awareness about how expensive it is to smoke. You provide a tool on your website to show smokers how much they're spending every year on cigarettes and tobacco products. People, I think, are surprised how much that cost adds up as well.
I think if they really do the math correctly and they can just put in the number of cigarettes they smoke per day and it will automatically calculate that for them on the website, and you're right, they are shocked. The average individual that smokes a pack a day in Florida will spend about $2,100 a year on cigarettes if they smoke a pack a day.
And, of course, the cost is much higher when you think about the health issues that arise from smoking, the risk of heart disease and cancer. And, you know, overall, fewer Americans than ever are smoking, but do you have updated numbers on how many residents of the state are still smokers, Vicki?
Yes, we do. I can tell you that the adult rate for smoking in the state of Florida in 2006 was about 21% of the population, the adult population in the state. And since the program has been initiated, which was in 2007, that 21% has gone down to about 15.5%. So it's really, really been successful. And another good statistic is the fact that the youth smoking rate has decreased from 10.6% to 2.5%. That's a 76% decrease. And of course, we know that is a very critical issue, is not to get people to start smoking when they're young, because it then becomes an addictive habit that's very, very hard to break.
One trend, though, that is kind of alarming, and you note this as well at Tobacco Free Florida, is vaping, e-cigarettes. How concerned are you about that? Because that's on the rise.
Yes, we are concerned, of course, because the e-cigarettes are not regulated at this point, and there are no evidence-based studies that have really been published. We don't have a direct program for that, but we do not encourage the use of the e-cigarettes. And there is evidence-based information out there that there are still upwards of 100 chemicals in the vaping liquid that people are ingesting, just like when they're inhaling smoke, they're inhaling the aerosol and the vape liquid. So they can be inhaling up to 100 chemicals.
Including nicotine. Do they have less nicotine than a traditional cigarette, but they are still delivering nicotine to the brain?
That's correct. And again, because they're unregulated, it's very difficult to know exactly how much nicotine is in the vape liquid. You can look at one of the little bottles and it might say 15 milligrams, but because it's unregulated and there's no quality control, it could have 20, it could have 5, you just don't know.
Now, Tobacco Free Florida is trying to get the word out as well for people who have a loved one that they'd like to help quit smoking. How can others be part of this program?
Well, what's really nice is, like you said, they can go on the website or they can call either the phone quit number or they can call us at Northeast Florida AHEC or any of the AHEC offices in the state and say they have a loved one that would like to quit. We can also talk to them about what is available, about our programs, give them our class schedules, or tell them about the phone and the web quit, and encourage them and give them tips to things that they can talk to their loved one about quitting.
What are some ways to talk to people? Because as you well know, smoking is so addictive, and it's as addictive as heroin. And people can talk a good game and say, yeah, I'm going to quit smoking, but talk is cheap. People really have a hard time making the decision to actually quit. And you know, my mother's passed away, but I remember growing up, she must have tried to quit dozens of times. But she never really quit until she was diagnosed with cancer. It was only when she got the cancer diagnosis that she finally quit for good. And so how do you really get through to someone who you know they need to quit, and they know they need to quit intellectually, but they just can't break the addiction? It's too powerful.
It is very difficult, and I can tell you there is no magic bullet. A person has to come to their own conclusion, and with a key technique that we use and our facilitators use and many of the clinicians use, it's called motivational interviewing, to really have deep conversations with individuals to try to understand what motivation to quit might be important to them. But it's still their decision. Of course, you know, they have to make the decision that they want to quit. And there's so many things out there that can help them if they make that decision. Trying to quit 12 times is not unusual, and mm-hmm. that's another thing many people don't understand. They said, oh, I've tried to quit many times before, and I just can't do it. Well, the average individual who does finally quit tries 7 to 10 times. So it's difficult. We know that, but there's a lot of support out there. If they want to make a quit attempt, we have got the tools that can help them.
Now, this is a free program, and it's administered through the Florida Department of Health. I'm just curious, how much of the funding for Tobacco-Free Florida, if any, came through the massive settlements that came from suing the tobacco companies, Vicki? Did any of your funding come from that? Because, of course, some lawyers here in Florida and even here in Jacksonville were instrumental in getting the getting the money out of the tobacco companies for all of the people that died from their many years of smoking.
That's correct. And once that settlement was finalized, of course, it was determined what percentage of that money is to go to the state every year, which the tobacco companies have to write that check. And it was legislated into the state constitution what percentage of that funding is to go toward the various tobacco programs within the state, whether it be education, cessation, or community interventions and communications. So, of course, that is all determined by our legislature, but it's been very robust over the years, and we've been very fortunate to have a funding in this area, and we've been tremendously successful in helping the people in this area with the funding that we have received quit using tobacco.
So again, as February kicks off, February is both American Heart Month and National Cancer Prevention Month. And tobacco is the leading cause of preventable death in this country, contributing both to cancer and heart disease. So if you smoke, you can get help, free help in this state to quit. There are so many ways that Tobacco-Free Florida wants to help you quit. It's not easy to quit. It really isn't. Very few people can do it alone. So if you need help, just go online to tobaccofreeflorida.com, tobaccofreeflorida.com, and get in touch with them. Quit smoking. Get healthier. Save your life. Thanks so much, Vicki Evans, Tobacco Program Manager with Tobacco Free Florida. We so appreciate you being on the show with us today. Thanks for spreading the word with us.
Well, thank you.
All right, and a quick break. In a moment, one of my favorite people, world traveler Judy Wells, with some ideas for where you need to be going in 2018. You're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9.
Vitamins and dietary supplements are a $37 billion business. I take them, maybe you do too. But what should we really be taking? And how do we know what's actually in that bottle? Supplements, safety, and snake oil. Next time on 1A. Weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, the secret history of Israel's targeted assassination program. We talk with Ronan Bergman. His new book, Rise and Kill First, investigates the methods, morality, and motives behind such killings and the controversies surrounding them. Bergman is the defense correspondent for Israel's largest newspaper. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Think about Pittsburgh today. Now think about it in the middle of the last century.
It was one of the most vibrant and influential black communities in all of America.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. The rise and economic fall of what was called Black Pittsburgh. That is next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Some of the hardest working people in America are teachers.
12-hour days, 5 days a week, binge grading on the weekends.
But why do they get so much disrespect?
It's convenient for certain kinds of groups to demonize education. What I've never quite understood is how exactly it got this bum rap.
Debating the purpose of school. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRX.
Sundays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, if you've decided 2018 is the year you're finally going to travel somewhere new, somewhere you've never been before, our travel expert Judy Wells is here with some ideas on great deals and amazing excursions. Always good to see you. You're just back from New York.
It's great. I am. I went to the New York Times travel show.
Nice.
And before that, though, I had taken all of the where to go in 2018 lists. Every single outfit that deals with travel puts one together. And I did the hard work for you. I compiled a list of places that were listed at least three times.
And you boiled it all down.
Lists.
Why can't everyone do the hard work for me?
I don't know. I wish they'd do it for me, too.
I know.
I went through so many lists, I was numb. But, and I've lost it here on my, can't get my
That's okay.
site back.
I will go to your website, which is wellsworld.net, and we will take a look. Now, this is Judy's Travel Trends for 2018, Where to Go. And this is basically, you know, the best of the best. Now, let's begin with Abu Dhabi and Dubai, United Arab Emirates.
You can do both of those in one.
Why do you recommend Abu Dhabi and United Arab Emirates?
Well, number one, Dubai has a wonderful institute where anybody can go and you learn more about the culture. It's over the top. It's everything over the top you ever want.
Yeah, I mean, you hear that it's the most lavish, luxurious, over-the-top place.
But it's also...
Is it too expensive to go
Not always. They've built so many hotels, and they're lovely hotels, that it really isn't that expensive.
Well, what would it cost the average traveler to fly there? That's a long way away.
However, Emirates and other airlines, I have seen flights for under $800.
Round trip. And you could get a reasonable hotel room.
Really? The food is not that expensive. Now, you do want to treat yourself to going to one of the major hotels.
Can you, as a woman traveling there, be reasonably assured that you can move about? Do you have to be veiled?
No.
Okay.
It's very urban, very sophisticated, particularly in Dubai. They ask that you not parade in your bikini across if you're at one of the waterfront hotels in the lobby. Cover up. But, you know, cover your shoulders, cover your legs. You're fine.
Okay.
A pair of slacks and a shirt.
Now, another interesting location Judy recommends is the Finnish Archipelago National Park in Finland.
Everybody was talking about archipelagos. Well, an archipelago is a big word for a lot of islands, a group of islands.
Right.
And the Faroes are interesting because they're not overdone.
What are the Faroes? An archipelago in Finland?
They're between Finland and Greenland, or Iceland, and they're isolated. They're perfectly beautiful. If you really want to be able to get away where it's quiet, you don't have tons of other tourists, that's a good place to go.
That's a place I've never heard of. Only you would know this. So yeah,
that sounds like an interesting place
to go.
I've been to Norway and I've been to those areas.
Okay, the Finnish archipelagos, the Faroe Islands. Okay, Argentina and Brazil.
You can get both of those if you go to Iguazu Falls, which I understand is spectacular. The pictures are certainly.
All of these pictures, by the way, are on Judy's website. All right, Bali, Indonesia. Of course, that is one of the top travel destinations in the world.
It is, and everybody wants, you know, a casita over the water. But I mean, you've got beach, you've got culture, you've got beauty. What's not to love?
Now, as I scroll down, you recommend Chile.
Chile is
South
long.
America.
Oh, I've been there. I've been from the top to the bottom. Chile is long and lean, and oh, the scenery you see from the Atacama Desert, which is the driest place on earth, down to Patagonia, and in the middle, the beautiful winelands.
And there are too many destinations on your website to get to them all. But before we wrap this up, you, Judy Wells, recommend Marrakesh, Morocco. Now, let me ask you really quickly. Morocco has come under some travel watch lists lately. Do you still recommend Morocco?
I'd go in a minute. It's on the top of my list.
You still would go?
I would go in a minute, a New York minute.
And what do you love about Morocco?
I'd go with a tour. I would probably go. I would go with a tour as a female traveling alone. It's the best way to go.
There is so much more on your website. Links to everything. Great information about deals, steals, little known pockets. Judy has been to, what is it like?
That's 64
300 countries.
Yeah,
I don't even know.
Wish I had. Wish would that I had. No, but there are also places not to go.
Okay.
Because tourism is just ruining them. It's aggravating and annoying the residents. It's destroying the very things that we go there to see.
Okay. Go to
wellsworld.net
for more. Where are you off to this month?
This month, I'll probably go to either someplace in Georgia. I think I'm thinking about DeLand. I haven't been there for a long
Georgia,
time.
Georgia, the state.
The state.
Yeah.
Or
okay.
Florida, DeLand. In March, I'm going back to China.
Really?
I've never seen the Warriors, Terracotta Warriors. And I want to see them. And I have a chance to do it now.
Well, enjoy yourself.
I shall.
We'll see you next time.
Okay.
All right. That's our show today. Thanks for listening. 1A is up next with your reactions to President Trump's first State of the Union address. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. If you missed any part of this program, our rebroadcast airs tonight at 8 o'clock. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.